Energy projects may take a while to develop, but there's still a race on for drilling rights in eastern Ohio. Some analysts say energy companies haven't been this interested in the Buckeye State since the late 19th century. That's when John D. Rockefeller opened Standard Oil in Cleveland. Mari Saito of member station WCPN has this story on oil and natural gas in what's called the Utica Shale.
If you want to interview Columbiana County Recorder Craig Brown, don't expect any privacy. As I talk to Brown at his desk, two people line up behind me to use the workstation in his office.
But yeah, and actually, yesterday I actually had four people in here, all waiting to use one microfilm viewer. So, yeah, I've actually given up some of my own personal space here, which is, it's taken a little bit of adjustment.
Brown's offices are packed with workers preparing oil and gas leases and researching the mineral rights of local homeowners. It's been like this every day for over a year. That's because less than a mile below this small Appalachian village and extending across eight states in Canada lies the energy-rich Utica Shale. Aubrey McClendon heads Chesapeake Energy, the country's second largest natural gas producer. He didn't skimp on the superlatives when describing the region this summer on CNBC's Mad Money.
What can it mean in the form of oil? I mean, I think this could be 25 billion barrels of oil equivalent in the form of oil, natural gas liquids, and natural gas can be one of our biggest discoveries in U.S. history.
ExxonMobil, Chevron, and Royal Dutch Shell are also chasing leasing rights here. But despite the hype, little is publicly known about how much oil and gas the Utica will actually produce. Tom Stewart is with Ohio's Oil and Gas Association. He says new technology makes Ohio an attractive place for drillers.
It's making formations such as the Utica Shale, where we always believed that the rock was so tight and dense that it would not yield the oil and gas, is taking formations like that and turning them into productive formations.
The technology making this possible is horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. Drillers inject huge volumes of chemical-laced water and sand into horizontal wells to extract the oil and gas. The method is controversial, and opponents argue the procedure, also known as fracking, can endanger drinking water. Bob Ray heads Ohio's largest nonprofit property owners group, the Associated Landowners of the Ohio Valley. Fracking controversies aside, his group has negotiated environmental protections, like liability clauses, into their leases with energy companies.
They're not coming here to ruin and wreck, but sometimes some common sense things get overlooked. Once you contaminate your water, you're stuck. So we want to make sure that this industry that's coming here understands how important this water is, and any burden of any occurrence falls on the shoulder of the driller.
While drilling in the Utica is in its infancy, the land rush has been an economic boon. Mary Catherine Nixon is the recorder in Ohio's Belmont County, just 10 miles from Wheeling, West Virginia. On a given day, Nixon says she's collecting $1,400 in copying fees alone from the 2 to 3 dozen mineral rights researchers who have camped out in her offices for months.
And I understand it's going to go on for months, but it's good for our economy. You know, Belmont County's like the rest of the state. We've been hurting, and I think this is going to be good for us. I'm hoping.
Some Ohio legislators have proposed banning fracking, at least until the EPA finishes up a study on its effects on drinking water. But the bill isn't expected to pass. In the meantime, the market for Ohio landowners with mineral rights is booming. Just over a year ago, leases were going for about $75 an acre plus royalties. There are reports now of landowners signing mineral rights leases for nearly $5,000 an acre. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. American women are having fewer babies. According to the Pew Research Center, the birth rate has been falling sharply since 2007, when more than 4.3 million babies were born. The reason? Demographers say it's the weak economy and high unemployment. For more, we're joined by Carl Haub. He's the senior demographer for the Population Reference Bureau. Carl, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
Let me start with where we are at today. Give me a sense of how the economy has affected birth rates in the U.S. since the start of the recession in 2008.
Well, in 2007, in terms of numbers, we had about 4.3 million births.
The highest number in American history, right?
Yes, correct. Even higher than the baby boom. But, of course, that's because our population is larger. In 2010, we had 4 million. In fact, we almost dipped below 4 million. Now, that's not a huge drop when you compare it to, say, the low birth rates in Europe. but it's still 300,000 babies.
That's significant.
Yeah, and that matters, especially to companies. You know, demographers may care a little more about rates, but people who are trying to sell things care about numbers.
Give me a sense of how right now compares to other times when the economy went south, the Great Depression, for example.
Oh, yeah. We had two big drops in our birth rate in the 20th century. One, of course, was the Great Depression, and it bottomed out in 1936. And certainly, I think that is no surprise, and I doubt that anyone doubts what the cause was. Then in the 1970s, we hit our lowest birth rate in our entire history. In 1976, it was the only year in which American women averaged about 1.7 children. But that was a complicated decade. The birth rate really began dropping in the late 60s, and I think most people believe that that was due to changing roles of women and the way, you know, what women saw as their future and as their role in life. Certainly, we had Roe versus Wade in the early 70s, 1973, I believe. And then we had the gas crisis. Plus, we had stagflation. We had rapidly increasing housing prices, but salaries stayed the same.
Clear through the late 80s, the 90s, and into the 2000s, the birth rate in the U.S. was pretty steady, around 2.0, sometimes a little bit higher than that. Now it's just slightly below 2. So it's not always the economy which is the central factor here, right?
No, it's not always. There are, as I say, I think the 70s was a decade of a really profound social change. But now when we look at the drop in the birth rate today, that's all been done. Now we have, I think it's probably fair to say that the only factor we can really look to is the economy.
And should we expect, and we don't have the data for 2011, but do you expect those numbers to continue to fall?
I would say yes. I won't hedge the bet on the question. I would say yes. If they stopped going down, it wouldn't be a total surprise. If they went up, it would be a shock.
If 4.3 million babies were born in the U.S. in 2007, and that number dropped to 4 million last year, and we can expect that number to have dropped even further this year, what are some of the consequences here? What does this mean now, 20 years on?
Sure. First and foremost, for today, it certainly means a declining and shrinking market for all of the things that young families would buy. If you have, say, 300,000 fewer babies born to marketers and companies, that's not good news. Then as we look further down the road, school enrollments will begin to fall. We would need fewer teachers. Colleges and universities might have some difficulty in, you know, in bringing in students that they would like to.
So this is going to have an economic effect.
Certainly. And it'll vary by state, of course. The drops have been larger in some states, say in Arizona. A school board, I think, that looks at 15% fewer students has some tough decisions to make down the road.
Carl Haupt, thank you so much.
And thank you, too.
That's Carl Haupt. He's senior demographer for the Population Reference Bureau, talking about the declining birth rates here in the U.S.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. President Obama has hosted many world leaders at the White House. Today is the first time he's taken one of them far outside of Washington. South Korea's president went along on a tour of a Michigan car plant. And Mr. Obama took the opportunity to talk up the new free trade deal between the U.S. and South Korea.
Our trade is basically balanced between the United States and Korea. They buy as much stuff from us as they sell to us. And that's how fair and free trade is supposed to be. It's not a one-sided proposition.
NPR's Ari Shapiro traveled with both presidents today to Orion Township in Michigan. And just after the speeches were over, Ari explained to us from a crowded room why they were there.
This is the General Motors assembly plant outside of Detroit, where they're building a subcompact car called the Chevy Sonic. The White House says it's the only subcompact car currently sold in the U.S. that is being built here in the United States. It was originally engineered in Korea. Now it's being assembled here in Michigan. And President Obama said that he expects soon South Koreans will be buying lots of American cars thanks to the free trade deal that Congress passed with South Korea this week.
Ari, the car makers, the union, they are fans of this free trade agreement between the U.S. and South Korea that was finally passed this week. But more broadly in Michigan, what is the sentiment there?
Here's one indication. When Air Force One landed in Detroit today, no one from the Michigan congressional delegation was here to greet the president. Most Michigan Democrats voted against this trade deal. The car workers union likes it. A lot of the other unions are very skeptical. They say South Korea may flood the American market. Companies might ship jobs overseas. You know, that's always a concern with trade deals, but it's especially acute here in Rust Belt states like Michigan that rely on manufacturing. President Obama says the deal will create 70,000 new American jobs, more than $10 billion in exports. But those jobs could be in other states and other industries, so people in Michigan are frankly a little bit skeptical.
But wasn't this deal, this trade deal, supposed to include programs to retrain displaced workers?
Yes, and ultimately that did bring some Democrats on board. President Obama talked about those provisions today. He said the deal he inherited from President Bush was not good enough for him. He went back to the drawing board, he said, and he compared it to haggling at a GM plant where you're talking about heated seats. He says ultimately the deal that he and South Korea agreed on is going to be good for America.
Now, the president is also using this trip to Michigan to talk up his decision to come to the rescue of the American auto industry. What did he say about that?
Well, he defended the decision. You remember that was a controversial decision at the beginning of President Obama's term, and it's still controversial. As he pointed out in the speech today, Mitt Romney, running for president, criticized the decision in a debate Tuesday night. But President Obama argued today that it was the right decision. He said the investment paid off. He said the hundreds of thousands of jobs that have been saved made it worth it. He said the profitable auto industry in the U.S. now makes it worth it. And the taxpayers, he said, are being repaid.
Ari, this trip is not just about the politics of trade. This is very much about the politics of re-election. How prominent was that part of the president's message today?
Well, his speech ended with, yes, we can. You know, Michigan is very important to President Obama's re-election strategy in several ways. This is a state that has chosen the Democrat in every presidential election since 1988. But in 2010, the Tea Party wave that swept across the country carried a Republican governor in here and Republican members of Michigan's state legislature. Democrats feel very strongly that if they lose this state, they are really in trouble. You know, in terms of ideology, they say the auto industry here is evidence that the government can do good things, which is the Democrats' argument here. You can expect to hear President Obama make that argument a lot here in Michigan and across Rust Belt states and the country over the next year.
Ari, thanks so much.
Good to talk to you, Guy.
That's NPR's White House correspondent, Ari Shapiro.
As we've heard, President Obama said today what he has said repeatedly about the trade agreement with South Korea, that it will benefit the U.S. auto industry.
Just as Americans buy Hyundais and Kias, I hope that South Koreans will buy more Fords, Chryslers, and Chevys.
Well, reporter Eric Martin writes about this for Bloomberg News today, and the headline of his article is, Koreans driving Chevys aren't assured by U.S. trade accord. And Eric Martin joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And first, let's acknowledge that the trade agreement with South Korea is likely to boost many U.S. exports, machinery, chemicals, plastics. But what about cars?
Cars will see some gains from this, but not nearly as much as some proponents and some supporters had hoped. We currently sell 13,000 cars, the U.S., to Korea each year versus about 600,000 Korean cars coming into the U.S. So clearly there's a big deficit in car exports, and this agreement will help some, but it doesn't change the taste of South Korean car buyers and consumers. And that is an issue that underlies a lot of the concern analysts have about making very broad and aggressive projections about how many cars will sell because of this.
But back to the president's stated desire to see folks in South Korea driving Fords and Chevys and Chryslers. There's a story in USA Today which says, and I quote, Fords and Chryslers maybe, but folks in South Korea do drive Chevys. And it says that GM Korea is actually a very big player there already.
That's right. GM has a unit formerly known as Daewoo, which is now being branded under the GM and Chrysler brands. And so there are some consumers in South Korea who are driving cars made by them, but that's under that brand. And a lot of those cars are actually made in South Korea. They're not necessarily exported from the U.S.
Well, how important, compared to what you described, is the fairly bleak prospects for huge car sales by the American automakers exporting to South Korea? How important was this language about the automobiles to getting approval of the deal with South Korea?
The language about Fords, Chevys, and Chryslers has been the main rhetorical point that President Obama has used in talking about the agreements. When he made his speech to a joint session of Congress on September 8th, talking about his jobs proposals and this $447 billion plan that's now being debated, this was the line he used to talk about American exports. There are many industries that will benefit actually more potentially than autos, beef, machinery, chemicals. Producers of all of those are also excited about these agreements, but the cars aspect of it has really been used as an emblem of how American ingenuity and production are going to benefit.
And it won over some important votes in Congress from Michigan, say?
It did. The Obama administration spent 2 years renegotiating parts of the CARS agreement in the South Korea Free Trade Accord. They got the ability for U.S. car manufacturers to export 25,000 vehicles a year that meet U.S. safety standards but not the more stringent South Korean safety standards. They also got an aspect of this agreement where U.S. makers can send cars that exceed the South Korean emissions rule by up to 19%. So both of those were aspects that were renegotiated by the Obama administration and won the support of initial opponents of this agreement, which were Ford, the United Auto Workers Union, and Michigan Congressman Democrat Sander Levin. And we've also seen a reduction, a scaling back in the tariff reductions, the speed with which this change would happen, so they wouldn't face an onslaught from Kia and from Hyundai.
Well, Eric Martin, thanks a lot for talking with us about this story.
Thanks for having me on.
Eric Martin, who's global trade reporter for Bloomberg Government and Bloomberg News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.